I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Gay rights activists are claiming victory this morning after the Supreme Court struck down a Texas law banning sodomy between gay couples. We'll have more on that decision in a moment. Other decisions handed down today include one that upholds the statute of limitations on child molestation cases in California and another that grants a second trial for a man on death row. The court decided not to consider the so-called Nike case regarding freedom of speech and advertising. Well, joining us to talk about some of these decisions is Professor Robert Shapiro of Emory University Law School. Welcome, Professor.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk about the child molestation rulings first. In that case, the Supreme Court decided that the statute of limitations can't be retroactively extended in sex abuse cases. So can you start by giving us a hypothetical example of the impact of this decision?
Well, I think where we are likely to see the impact is in exactly this kind of case. Recently, there's been a great deal of concern with the problem of child sexual abuse and the fact that these allegations often aren't made till long after the crime may have occurred. That is, children are very reluctant to turn in their parents or other loved ones who may be, in fact, the people who are committing these acts. So what California tried to do here was to say, all right, well, even if it's been a very long time since the child sexual abuse occurred, if it's reported to the police, then we can forget about the prior statute of limitations. That's what California tried to do here, trying to really effectively revive a prosecution for sexual acts that had allegedly taken place 20 years earlier. And the Supreme Court said you can't do that, that if the statute of limitations had expired as it had done here long before, that however laudable the goal, that person is just no longer subject to prosecution.
And Professor, I'm thinking this might have some impact on the current priest sex abuse cases.
Oh, absolutely. Priests and others, really any kind of instance where there might be sexual abuse of children and where in the past there have been relatively short statutes of limitations. There may be relatively little problem going forward as states become more aware of this problem, and for the future, we'll have much longer statutes of limitations for allegations of child sexual abuse. But certainly for crimes in the past, it could be a problem.
What does this mean for prosecutors?
Well, it certainly makes it very difficult for prosecutors if there are people who come forward reporting sexual incidents that happened a very long time ago. The prosecutors may just have to tell them that they're very sorry, but that the statute of limitations has elapsed and there's really nothing that can be done.
I'm sure there's going to be some reaction to that. In another case, the court agreed with a convicted murderer that his lawyers botched his trial, and so he's going to get a second trial. Let's talk about the third case, the Nike case, it's being called, which the court dismissed this morning. A man is suing the company or was suing the company for false claims in Nike's promotional materials. This was sort of a corporate PR campaign, and Nike had argued that its advertising claims in that campaign are protected by free speech. And as we said, these allegedly false claims were not related to Nike's products, but about working conditions at the company's overseas factories. So the Supreme Court says it's not going to hear the case. In fact, it shouldn't even have taken it as far as it did. What does that mean?
Well, that's right. It's in some ways a bit of a disappointing outcome for many who are looking to this case to clarify so-called commercial speech. As this case really raised one of those issues about what kind of speech is it, the court has given very careful protection to political speech, speech about issues of ongoing public concern, and the Supreme Court has given less protection for commercial speech, speech that tries to sell a product. Now, here, when a corporation is defending itself with regard to allegations about overseas conditions, well, it really is talking about a public issue and also trying to sell products, so it presented very difficult questions.
And what does it mean? Does this man still get to sue Nike? Does it go back to court?
Absolutely. Mr. Caskey will get to proceed with his lawsuit in California courts. Though I think Nike could take some comfort from the fact that the three justices who said that the court should have heard the case, Justices Kennedy, Breyer, and O'Connor, suggested that they thought that the California law might very well be unconstitutional. So it does suggest that Nike might fare better when the case finally reached some ultimate conclusion in the California courts and then came up to the Supreme Court again for review.
Well, Professor, thank you so much. Busy morning.
Absolutely.
And just real quick from you, we just have a few seconds. There's been rumors of some of the justices stepping down. What do you think?
Well, there are rumors every year. Certainly, a lot of rumors that the Chief Justice was going to step down, and everybody thought there'd be a good chance, but we certainly haven't heard anything about it yet.
Yeah. Stay tuned. Professor Robert Shapiro, thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Shapiro is a professor of law at Emory University Law School.
One of the highly awaited decisions this morning was the Supreme Court's ruling on a Texas law that made sodomy between gay couples illegal. Joining us now to discuss that decision further is Kevin Cathcart. He is executive director of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, a gay rights group, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello.
First, tell us a bit about the specific case that was brought all the way to the Supreme Court.
Well, Lambda has, for over 4 years now, represented two men who were arrested in September of 1998 in one of their homes. The police burst in after false reports of a weapons violation in the area, found them having sex behind closed doors in someone's private home, and instead of continuing on to look for the alleged weapons violator in the neighborhood, the police stopped and arrested these men for violating what is called in Texas the homosexual conduct law. And we've challenged the validity of that law, and we are very, very excited today that the court has ruled that law unconstitutional, at the same time overturning the decision in Bowers v. Hardwick, which was the court's 1986 decision on a challenge to the Georgia sodomy law.
And specifically, what were the grounds under which the law was overturned?
Under due process grounds, the court found that our petitioners, and this case is much bigger than just our petitioners, the men who were arrested, because it applies not only to all gay people, but really to all Americans, have a right to privacy in their home and have a right to private behavior, that the state does not have the authority to come in and to police.
Well, how key a decision is this? Because certainly the sodomy laws are not all that frequently enforced. As you say, this was kind of a fluke that this case even came up.
It's a monumental decision. And if I could think of a word stronger than monumental, I would use that. There are 13 states left, or there had been 13 states until today, that had enforceable sodomy laws on the books. But the problem with sodomy laws goes beyond just police and arrests. Sodomy laws are often cited in other kinds of cases, child custody cases, for example. They're used to argue against other civil rights protections on the basis of sexual orientation. They have a very long reach. The Bowers v. Hardwick decision was a very ugly decision that has been used against gay people for 17 years now, and it was an amazing moment in the court this morning to hear Justice Kennedy say that the rationale in Bowers was not correct when it was decided and is not correct now. He went on to say Bowers should be and is overruled.
Well, as you know, the prosecutors in this case were arguing that Texas citizens have a right to ban conduct that they think is immoral.
Yes, and the court pointed out today, as it is the Supreme Court's job to point out, that the United States Constitution sets baselines for law in this country, and that we do have, in America, rights to privacy and rights to liberty. And the court made clear that those rights to privacy and liberty apply to everyone, gay and straight, that they are not something, as Texas had argued, that can only be held applicable to straight people.
And so a different standard of community standards, in your view.
It is a new day.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kevin Cathcart is executive director of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. He joined us on the line from Washington.
Thank you.
This note, 40 years ago today, President John F. Kennedy stood in front of the Berlin Wall in what was then West Germany and spoke passionately about the divide between East and West.
While the wall is the most obvious and vivid demonstration of the failures of the communist system, for all the world to see, we take no satisfaction in it, for it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity, separating families, dividing husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and dividing a people who wish to be joined together.
Of course, many people only remember four words from that speech.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
I am a Berliner. The crowd understood his gesture to them and roared approval. But other people later questioned the phrase because some interpreted it to mean, I am a jelly donut. Listen closely. At the time, even Kennedy seemed to know he might not be understood.
I appreciate my interpreter translating my German.
Well, according to linguists, Kennedy's use of the phrase was correct because he was speaking metaphorically. This non-native was saying he was like a German. If native Germans said it, it would have meant, I am a jelly donut. But no one would confuse the two statements in the context. So Kennedy's German was correct and his sentiments clear. He concluded the speech by looking forward to the day he would not live to see, the day in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down.
When that day finally comes, as it will, the people of West Berlin can take sober satisfaction in the fact that they were in the front lines for almost two decades. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
President John F. Kennedy speaking on the western side of the Berlin Wall 40 years ago today.
A woman on the radio talks about revolution when it's already passed her by. Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about, you know it.
Just ahead, American teachers want to know who killed their colleagues in an ambush in Indonesia.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris, in for Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Last summer, a group of American schoolteachers set out on a picnic in the lush rainforest of West Papua, Indonesia. On the way home, they were ambushed. Bullets ripped through their SUVs, killing two of them and wounding eight. Now, 10 months later, the U.S. government is still trying to figure out who did it. So far, the best evidence points to the Indonesian army. which makes things awkward for Washington since the Indonesian government is a key ally in the war on terror. Dana Priest is a reporter for The Washington Post who investigated the story, and she joins us now from Washington. Welcome, Dana.
Good to be here, Gail.
Well, thanks for joining us, and thanks for your reporting on this, because it is a truly horrific story. Let's start with what actually happened. I mean, who were these people, and what were they doing there?
Well, the school teachers were contract workers for the Freeport Gold Mine, which is the largest gold mine in the area, in the world, actually. And they have a tremendous amount of security nearby, and in fact, they employ 2,000 military and police from Indonesia to help them guard the mine and all the surrounding areas. So the area itself is a closed-off area. You can't go there unless you're an employee or you have permission, and then you have to sign in the road along the way from the mine and down to other parts of the area. So these school teachers worked there. They taught the kids of the mine employees who are British and Australian and American, and they decided to go on a picnic to show the new teachers the incredible flora and fauna of the area. It is one of the most ecologically diverse areas in the whole world. And so they were coming back down from the picnic when their two vehicles were attacked by people that only some of them could even see in the hail of bullets that continued throughout a 45-minute period and really chewed up everyone who was inside. Some of them escaped, and one couple in particular who had a 6-year-old daughter escaped to the outside of their van, hid behind a tire, but unfortunately the father kept getting in the way of the bullets and lost so much blood they thought that he was going to die. And they both told me that at that moment they prayed together and they talked about what they would do if he did die there. And he told his wife, just get down from the mountain, leave this area. It was just such a horrendous ambush in and of itself. And for the survivors, who really, it was the first time the survivors had talked to anybody, and they are convinced, after the Indonesian police conducted an investigation, they are convinced that the Indonesian army likely had a hand in this.
Well, we want to mention that while you are now describing this experience in some detail, there are even more of these chilling details in the full story. We want to encourage our listeners to read the full account. But let's spend a moment on why they think that there was a connection to the Indonesian army, because as you say, these were the very people who were paid by the mining company to protect them. So why would they want to attack?
Good question. And there are two theories, and they're only theories because no one is talking, as you can imagine in this case. But the predominant one, based on some good information, it's not just guesswork, is that the army wanted to frame a tiny separatist movement that operates in that area but is unarmed, largely unarmed now, and has renounced violence, wanted to frame them so that the U.S. would call them terrorists and put them on the terrorist list and then give them, the Army, more counterterrorism training and money. Because our government has always had a hands-off and very conflicted relationship with the Indonesian Army because of its long record of human rights abuses against the people of East Timor and Aceh and the Moluccas in particular and the Papuans. So we've always had this very debatable relationship with the military. We fund them sometimes, and other times, like in 99, when President Clinton knew that the military had participated in the violence in East Timor, he cut off funds. And now they saw, the prevailing theory is the military saw this as a chance to get closer to our military and our intelligence agencies through the counterterrorism mantra. The second theory is that perhaps it were local commanders who wanted to show the Freeport Mining Company that they really needed them, and perhaps to get more money from the Freeport Mining Company to pay more military guards and what have you.
Well, in terms of the first theory, are we talking about a significant amount of money here?
Well, this is interesting because right now the Defense Department gives the Indonesians $4 million as of last year in counterterrorism training, and that's entirely new. But because before that, our aid to the Indonesians was a trickle, was just a couple $100,000 in military training, and it was all non-lethal. But once the 9/11 happened and the U.S. government wanted Indonesia as an ally, it said, well, we're going to put counterterrorism above all other priorities, and we will give them this money. Separately, there is $600,000 in the pipeline for other types of military training, and that money is right now under debate in Congress.
Because of this incident?
Absolutely. There's actually, from last year, $400,000 in separate military training money that the State Department has not released because it feels unclear about whether the Indonesians are really helping in this investigation. So there's another $600,000 that Congress will vote on in a couple weeks, and the survivors are trying their hardest to lobby Congress not to give that money over until they're assured of the basics, which would be that the Indonesian military is cooperative in the FBI investigation, because up until this point they have not been.
And meanwhile, Patsy Spear, whose husband Rick was one of the people killed in this attack, is walking through the halls of Congress, has 70 pieces of shrapnel still inside her body. It makes you wonder, is it more important that she get justice or that Indonesia remain an ally in the war on terrorism?
Well, that is exactly the calculation. And her argument would be, what kind of ally kills Americans in the name of counterterrorism? I think that's a very good question.
Well, we thank you for bringing it to us, Dana Priest.
Thank you.
Dana Priest covers national security affairs for The Washington Post. You can read her entire article on our website at here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here Now, a reporter visits the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay to find out what's happening with the hundreds of prisoners still being held there by the U.S. military.
And our film reviewers on Stone Reader, the story of one man's search for his favorite one-hit wonder author.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now. Coming up, new research raises questions for women using hormone replacement therapy for short-term relief of symptoms of menopause.
They have to say, do I want these symptoms to be 90%, 100% relieved at the cost of having a 1 in 25 chance of having an abnormal mammogram at the end of 1 year and then dealing with that?
Also, you stepped up to the plate for our latest poetry challenge, baseball poems.
There once was a man called the Rocket. He is a great pitcher, can't knock it. He's one win away, but Boston fans pray his arm will fall out of its socket.
Coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The Supreme Court today struck down a ban on gay sex, ruling that a Texas law against sodomy was an unconstitutional violation of privacy. The 6-3 vote represents a major shift for the court, which ruled 17 years ago that states could punish homosexuals for having sex. The three dissenters on today's decision were Chief Justice William Rehnquist, Justice Antonin Scalia, and Justice Clarence Thomas. In another decision, the court dealt a setback for prosecutors seeking to prosecute sex crimes committed years ago. In a 5-4 ruling, the justices struck down a California law saying prosecutors cannot retroactively wipe out statutes of limitations. And in an important test of legal standards for capital punishment cases, the justices threw out the death sentence of a convicted killer in Maryland, ruling that inexperienced lawyers botched the man's case at trial. More ambush attacks against U.S. troops in Iraq today. A U.S. Marine was killed, two others injured when their vehicle rolled over as they sped to the scene of another attack, and two Iraqi electrical workers died in an ambush of a U.S.-led convoy. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials say two U.S. soldiers and their Humvee are missing in Baghdad. American forces have been searching the Iraqi capital for the two soldiers for hours now. Mixed messages from Palestinians today on a much-talked-about ceasefire agreement. A Hamas leader says it's too early to call off attacks on Israelis, while Yasser Arafat says an agreement could come in a matter of hours. A senior Hamas leader is reportedly on his way back from Egypt with a copy of the truce document. A federal appeals court says suspected terrorist Zacharias Moussaoui has the right to question an alleged al-Qaeda operative during his conspiracy trial. The decision overturns a lower court ruling in the case. Moussaoui says Ramzi bin al-Shib, an alleged conspirator in the September 11th attacks, can back up his claims that he was not involved in the attacks. At this hour, President Bush is unveiling what his administration is calling a comprehensive agenda on Africa. The president is announcing a new $100 million aid package to fight terrorism. The plan provides money to increase security for airports and seaports in Africa. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 59 points at 9070. The Nasdaq is up 27 at 1630. And the S&P 500 is up 8 points at 983. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harrison for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The hormone replacement therapy that women commonly use to treat symptoms of menopause is once again being questioned. Last year, researchers found that long-term use of estrogen and progestin for other health issues, such as heart disease and osteoporosis, actually caused a slight increase in the risk of breast cancer. Well, this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers published more findings saying that even short-term use of estrogen and progestin makes breast cancer harder to detect. Well, joining us on the line is lead investigator of the study, Dr. Rowan Jabowski. Dr., welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's be clear. When you say short-term use, what do you mean?
Well, our results are an extension of the previous Women's Health Initiative report of last year. Our findings essentially were that relatively short-term use resulted in increased breast cancers found at more advanced stage and were associated with substantially increased abnormal mammograms. Now, the abnormal mammograms occurred after only 1 year of estrogen and progestin use, and it looked like they were blocking or making more difficult to make a breast cancer diagnosis.
Again, back to the short-term use. If these were the women in the other study, then these were women who were older in years, postmenopausal, and using it, as we said, to deflect other health issues. Do your findings apply to women who might be, you know, in their early 50s and using it to offset the symptoms of menopause, the hot flashes and other symptoms?
One would have to make an inference, but a third of the women, so that would be thousands of women, were between the ages of 50 and 59. In that group, abnormal mammograms were also substantially increased.
Well, this is going to be, as you know, devastating to women who thought, well, okay, I'm just using it for a couple of years for, you know, to offset the symptoms of menopause. I'm not one of those women in the other studies that's using it, say, to prevent heart disease. This is new and devastating information.
Well, I think it's new, but it'll be just another factor that women should consider. If they're considering short-term use and have moderate, mild vasomotor symptoms, hot flashes, they have to say, do I want these symptoms to be 90%, 100% relieved at the cost of having a 1 in 25 chance of having an abnormal mammogram at the end of 1 year and then dealing with that?
Mm.
And so I think for some women with severe symptoms, it'll be easy decision to go ahead with the therapy. I think there'll be some women on the margins who will say, since the symptoms often go away with time, maybe I'll see what happens.
Yeah, go to the black cohosh.
Yes.
But tell me, how does it affect the mammograms? What happens? Is it that you can't see growth?
Well, we're not sure. I mean, this is a new finding. One thing we've known for a couple of years is that estrogen and progestin increases breast density. The glandular tissue makes the mammograms look a little whiter, and it's maybe just masking ability to detect small masses, but that will be studied.
Right. And so perhaps if women are going to use the combination for short-term use, and by the way, we should remind people, estrogen alone has been shown to cause an increase in uterine cancer, so that's why the progestin is added in the combination. But does this mean that perhaps someone who chooses to use that should also maybe have better breast cancer detection?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, in this study, almost all the women, over 90% of the women, had yearly mammograms and yearly clinical breast exams, which many women don't have. And even with that, the cancers were found at somewhat advanced stage. So that makes having an abnormal mammogram a little bit more of an issue, because not only do you have to deal with it, but one has to know that the answers are somewhat less reliable. So it is a little bit more of an issue. But you mentioned estrogen alone, and estrogen alone for women who, for one reason or another, had a hysterectomy, we're not sure about whether it has the same effects on mammograms or breast cancer. And there is an ongoing study in the Women's Health Initiative looking at that, and that will give an answer in at least 2 years.
And doctor will be eager to hear it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Rowan Chabowski is an oncologist at the Harbor UCLA Research and Education Institute in Torrance, California. He spoke to us about his findings relating short-term hormone replacement therapy with problems with breast cancer detection. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
The New York City Department of Education has announced a plan to reduce the fat content in school lunches. According to the New York Times, the nation's largest school system serves more meals than any other government agency except the Department of Defense, even as obesity among New York children has reached astonishing proportions, up to 20% of students in some grades. Martin Ostreicher is the chief executive of the Office of School and Support Services, which developed the new, healthier standards. Hello, Martin.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We understand that some of the longtime staples that probably many of us remember, things like beef ravioli and potato salad and certainly macaroni and cheese, are now off the menu. So what's left?
Well, I should say that they're not necessarily off the menu. Those popular staples are being reformulated. We've upgraded our standards a bit. And we now go back to the manufacturer and we'll say, well, we still want to serve this product. And the manufacturers generally, because of our size, will work with us. And in those particular products you mentioned, we haven't gotten it down yet. Either they've got the components where we wanted them, but the taste just did not pass the taste test with students and others. But we still think we'll be able to serve those products next year.
And is there any indication that the kids will actually eat the healthier versions? I mean, do you have focus groups and taste testers there?
Yeah, exactly right. We believe they will. Generally, when we redo a product or introduce a new product, we will have some taste testing amongst ourselves. But sometimes adult tastes are not similar to children's tastes. So we will then do fairly extensive taste testings, random samplings at all levels, elementary school, middle school, and high schools. And we'll get some feedback from the students. And if it passes at that very tough constituency, then we'll introduce it into the menus.
And I understand you're also cutting down on the junk food that's available from vending machines. What's in there now and what will be?
Right now, schools have been able to purchase vending machine deals on their own. And some of the items they have in there, such as sodas and candy, chocolates, gum, those items will have to go.
I also understand, though, it's going to take the city until 2008 to meet the federal recommendations that fewer than a third of calories come from fat. That seems like a long time. Why would it take 5 years?
The standard now is that on a five-day average, no more than 30% of the caloric intake can be fat. And, in fact, we're meeting that standard right now. What we're doing in upgrading it is to take that not on a five-day average, but to do that on a daily basis. Naturally, we said that will be transitioned. We're working on it now in terms of reformulating our products, but we have a lot of products, and we just don't think we can do that within a couple of months. It'll take a couple of years to get us to where we can meet that 30% on any given day.
Well, Martin, thank you very much, and speaking as a parent, good luck.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Martin Ostreicher heads the Office of School and Support Services in New York City.
Still to come, peanuts and Cracker Jacks and poetry, yours. Listeners hit their baseball poems out of the park.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our recent talk with high school teacher Eric Jolma of Winnett, Montana, caught the attention of Roger Shelton in Bristol, New Hampshire. Like Eric, Roger could possibly lose his job because the federal No Child Left Behind education law requires teachers to have college degrees in every course they teach. Roger writes, "I have taught for 26 years, was nominated once for New Hampshire Teacher of the Year, and had the yearbook dedicated to me twice. But according to President Bush, I'm not qualified to be in my classroom. So I think I'll run for the Senate and propose a bill that requires all politicians to have a teaching certificate before they can vote on education legislation."
A number of you took issue with the reporter Andrea Stone, who said in our recent Washington roundtable that Democratic presidential hopeful Howard Dean hit some stumbling blocks during his interview with Tim Russert on Meet the Press. Randy Hatch writes, "Who cares if Dean knows the exact number of soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan? Evidently Stone and Russert do. Bush didn't know the correct information on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and he started a war based on that misinformation."
Well, Bill Delaney spoke with Philippe Legrand, author of Open World, Truth About Globalization. They talked about Europeans working far less hours than Americans, and that prompted a response from Barbara Brandt of Somerville, Massachusetts, who's on the line. Barbara, what were your thoughts?
Well, Bill laughed and said, "That's so un-American to work less." And my immediate thoughts were that actually the majority of Americans do want to work much, much less, and that's why I'm working with a new national movement called Take Back Your Time Day.
Well, many, I'm sure, would agree with you with that analysis, but I'm sure you saw there was an article in the New York Times. NYU professor Niall Ferguson drew upon the teachings of German sociologist Max Weber to say that it's the American Protestant work ethic that is fueling the economy, and it's because Americans work thousands of hours more than Europeans that we actually have the better economy.
That may have been true in the past, and I don't know because I'm not an economist. But the fact is that now many management specialists are observing that people who are overworked and burned out actually are much less productive.
I'm sure you loved hearing author Philippe Legrand say the same thing. I mean, he feels that's why the European economy is going to surge ahead, because people are better rested and they're happier.
And it's a lesson that we could learn here in the U.S.
Well, Barbara, I have a feeling that a lot of our listeners will be interested in hearing more, so we will link them to your website.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally, we admit to an egregious error that many of you pounced on. Zhao Gilberto did not write The Girl from Ipanema, as we said in our introduction to a review of his music. Antonio Carlos Jobim wrote that song. By way of apology, we offer three versions of the classic by Gilberto and his wife Astrid Gilberto, also Ricky Lee Jones and Whistler Lorindo Almeida.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, it's when she passes.
be what your soul shall be.
As always, we love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's America's favorite pastime. It's the stuff dreams and apparently poems are made of. It's baseball. And we received some lovely pieces of poetry after Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo issued their latest challenge for baseball poems. Jim and Molly are back in the studio to see what you all came up with. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Robin.
Hey, Robin.
Boy, Jim, your idea struck a chord with other listeners, your favorites.
I really hit a home run with this one, Robin.
Okay.
You made it past first base. Go, Jim, go.
Yeah, for the first time ever. This is from Bill Ross. This mentions another. We had introduced alphabet poems on the air a while ago, and this is actually an alphabet poem about baseball. It's called Fundamentals of the Game. American baseball, cut diamonds, Elysian fields. Games home, infield jabbering, kids laughing, making noise, outfield positioned, quick, ready, set. The umpire's voice wafts. Xanadu, Yaki, Zen. He actually gets an X in there. Usually people cheat on the X and the Z and stuff like that, but it ends up pretty good. Thank you, Bill Ross of East Hampton, Massachusetts.
Well, Baseball on the Radio was one sent to us by Lori Coyley Massing of Watertown, Massachusetts. A lot of people wrote about loving to listen to baseball, and that brings us to Bill Latanzi of Cambridge, Massachusetts. He wrote about something familiar to many of us, being torn between two teams, and also he wrote about announcers. So we asked him the inspiration for his poem.
Well, the chance to talk to you, of course.
Okay, and then?
Well, I heard your segment, and it got me thinking about baseball as a kind of source of continuity through change. And this one guy, Bob Shepard, the guy who announces the Yankee games, and he's still going at it. I looked it up, and I think he's been there now for over 50 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, no surprise, you titled your poem Bob Shepard. Let's hear it.
Okay. Bob Shepard. Transmigratory birds, Orioles, Jays, Cards, in town one day, gone the next. Our cities connect by rail, by bus, by train, by plane, by wire, and less. We move. Born in the suburbs, 90 miles from York Calm, Bob Shepard. Now batting, the center fielder, number 7, Mickey Mantle. And you were old then, doing your crosswords, looking up at just the right moment, never missing a line. Your PA voice sitting kindly between the squawk of the scooter and the old redhead, wised up, seen it all. We migrate and grow by rail and plane and PF Flyer, running faster, jumping higher. Now we're minutes from Fenway, and Sox fans, too, proof that peace is possible. It's all a game. And with my sons, we sit, ghost of my dad and we and them, and watch, rootless and rooted, rooting. And listen for you, Bob Shepard. 87, I think you are, still there, in between clever McCarver and professional Buck. Look up, Bob. Look up. Number 2, the shortstop, Derek Jeter. Jeter. The game goes on. That's it.
Well, thank you for sharing with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
What a connection. A lot of people mention that baseballs are connections, connections to generations past, connections all across the country. He talked about everyone coming in. That's one of the wonderful things about baseball is the way it connects people.
A lot of people wrote about opening day, different events in baseball.
Roger Clemens in his 300th game. Diane Folds wrote one that happened before he made his 300th game. There once was a man called the Rocket. He is a great pitcher. Can't knock it. He's one win away, but Boston fans pray his arm will fall out of its socket.
You see, why do we keep returning to this Yankees-Red Sox rivalry?
Well, Julie Donnelly from Raleigh, North Carolina, writes an ode to Clemens failing. Now, I mean, I loved Roger Clemens. You know, I'm glad he got 300 wins.
For those who are not as invested in baseball, he was with the Red Sox for 14 years. He was with the Yankees for like 2 days, and he's decided, now that he's got this record, when he goes into the Hall of Fame, he's decided to wear a Yankee hat, so it's caused a little bit of concern. Well, baseball is also really emotional. It hits at something with people. And Manette Rudell from Philadelphia wrote a piece about her father, the umpire. He's retired now at the age of 88, but he umped, would you say, Jim, baseball and softball for over 40 years.
This is called Dress Navy Blues. From sterling all-star athlete to a man with damaged back, my father found a new role on his beloved baseball diamond. With heavy foam chest protector, leather shin guards strapped in place, he ruled his umpire's kingdom in dress navy blues with authority and grace. Night after long summer night, we heard him call, "Ball! Strike!" with strong, certain voice and fairness in his eagle eyes. The fans, too, had their say, "Find your glasses! No way! No way!" But one who yelled, "Kill the umpire," went too far one sunny day. My little sister's angry fists pummeled his back as she said, "Stop saying that." Sheepish man shut up and learned what we already knew. Umpires are fathers and heroes, too.
I love that. Well, thank you, Manette, and thank you for reminding us that umpires are heroes, too.
Yes, thank you.
I loved how baseball touched people through their fathers. That happened quite often.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Eric Larson from Prescott Valley, Arizona, wrote about the sweetest baseball game of all, the kind that's just around the block from all of us, you know, the one played by local teams. Your poem's just a little bit long for our format, so I'm going to just summarize the top. You've gone down to the fields in Prescott Valley. On the first field, some teenagers are playing, as you write, looking to get past first base in more ways than one. Field number two, some older graying players. Number three is the Little League. But you choose number four. Would you start your read there, please?
I watch field four, where teen girls take the field. In the center, a girl, 15, studies the batter with an intense gaze usually reserved for portraits of Civil War generals. In school, she blends into the background, shy and retreating. Tall for her age since 11, awkward and quiet. Doesn't run with the popular girls, not a member of the Honors Club. But here she shines, up on a pedestal of packed earth, her fast-pitched slider a thing of legend and awe, if only to a select few. This is softball. And while the ring of aluminum may not inspire the epic weight of sentimentality the crack of hickory does, it has a music all its own. Baseball of today is a game played by millionaire athletes in billion-dollar ballparks named after dot-coms facing federal inquiry. I prefer the softer, slower, more intimate game under yellow-white lights and balmy June nights played for bragging rights and a small tin trophy, but mostly love of the game.
Eric, so nice. Thank you so much. You've inspired us all to head down to the local diamond.
Well, thank you. I hope you do.
Well, we mentioned that people were influenced by their fathers in their love for baseball, also very much so by their mothers, and that was illustrated in this poem from Bronwyn Texera from Paxton, Massachusetts. Her name in town is poetic, but here is her poem.
From the time he was born, I dreaded this day. He had that look in his eyes. He wanted to play. They had come back to haunt me, those evaded gym classes. I could no longer avoid it. I need to buy safety glasses. Out on the lawn with a bat in his hand, he recited the call, "Hit a homer, young man." Then he walks over to me as I weed in the garden. "Mom, can you pitch me some balls?" "I beg your pardon?" "I need to practice, Mom. I have a game tomorrow." The tone of his voice, I hear hope, yet sorrow. What else could I do? I pick up the ball. Don't worry, he says. We'll do grounders. That's all.
I love that. The sorrow of a 7-year-old. Apparently, Dad was away on a business trip, but that's a very poignant thought for those who don't have someone to help them teach their kids to play baseball.
She has a terrific baseball name.
Ronwyn Teixeira, thank you. And thanks to all of our listeners. We just loved your baseball poems. Well, Molly, what's the next challenge?
We're looking at postcards. Explanation at a later date.
Oh, a terrific summer topic as well. So, listeners, don't forget our baseball poems can be viewed at our website, here-now.org. And stay tuned for the next one.
Dum, dum, dum.
Wish you were here. Here and Now's roving poets Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley. Thank you both.
A pleasure, Robin.
I gotta get to Fenway.
Lazy stadium night. Catfish on the mound. Strike three, the umpire says. Batter has to go back and sit down. Kathy. $1 million man. Nobody can throw the ball like Kathy.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
But the old man wouldn't pay. So he packed his glove and took his arm.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the